This is podcast number 178 for the Well-Educated Mother's Heart. Hi, I'm Marlene Peterson, and today I want to spend more time on nature study. As we start another year through the rotation, I want to talk again about the difference between nature study and science, at least as I have learned to view it. This quote is found on the back of the Mother's Learning Library Nature Study book. Quote, "The value of nature study should not be measured by the acquisition of knowledge, but rather by the love and the profound reverence for the design and the protecting care revealed in the works and by an all-wise creator." Close quote. When the heart educators of 100 years ago suggested nature studies, they had their eye not just on the acquisition of knowledge, but on the underlying spiritual truths. You find this throughout their writings, which differentiates their writings from modern ones. For instance, in the teacher notes of a book written by Dallas Lore Sharp, who I'll talk about in a future Take 5, he gave this advice to the teacher. "Go yourself frequently into the fields and woods, or into the city parks, or along the waterfront, anywhere so that you can touch nature directly, and look and listen for yourselves. Don't try to teach what you do not know, and there is nothing in this book that you cannot know, for the lesson to be taught in each chapter is a spiritual lesson, not a number of bare facts. This spiritual lesson you must first learn before you can teach it, must feel, I should say, and a single thoughtful excursion alone into the autumn fields will give you possession of it." For most of us, when we begin to study anything, we do it through the eye of knowledge. So, for instance, this month we are studying the stars. You might be inclined to have your children make a chart of the planets in order, and maybe even memorize them. Study their relative size and the distance between each other. There's no end of facts you can accumulate about the stars and the universe. But facts, by themselves, are cold and hard. One day you may need a use for them, or a desire to know them to satisfy your own questions. But handed out as assignments, they don't serve much of a purpose on their own, although they can keep kids busy, and I guess there's something in that. I don't know about you, but as many times as I had to put the planets in order, I still can't do it. And not knowing that really hasn't posed a problem so far. Maybe if I were on Jeopardy and the final Jeopardy question had something to do with the fourth planet from the sun, I would wish I had paid closer attention. But overall, not knowing it hasn't been an obstacle. If I'm home and I care to know what the fourth planet is, I'll just ask Alexa. She knows everything. Let me share a few words from the great American naturalist, John Burroughs. "What knowledge I possess of her creatures and ways has come to me through contemplation and enjoyment, rather than through deliberate study of her. I have been occupied more with the spirit than with the letter of her works." In our time, which, by the way, he's writing 100 years ago and it's only gotten worse, it seems to me too much stress is laid upon the letter. We approach nature in an exact, calculating, tabulating, mercantile spirit. We seek to make an inventory of her storehouse. Our relations with her take on the air of business, not of love and friendship. The clerk of the fields and woods goes forth with his block of printed tablets upon which, and under various heads, he puts down what he sees, and, I suppose, loots it all up and gets at the exact sum of his knowledge when he gets back home. He is so intent upon the bare fact that he does not see the spirit, or the meaning of the whole, of that sympathetic and emotional intercourse with nature which soothes and enriches the soul, he experiences little or none. The knowledge of nature that comes easy, that comes through familiarity with her, as through fishing, walking, farming, that is the kind that reaches and affects the character and becomes a grown part of us. We absorb this as we absorb the air, and it gets into the blood. Fresh, vital knowledge is one thing. The desiccated fact is another. Do we know the wildflower when we've analyzed it and pressed it or made a drawing of it? Of course, this is one kind of knowledge and is suited to certain minds. But if we cannot supplement it with the other kind, the knowledge that comes through the heart and the emotions, we are poor indeed. I recently, continuing on, this is still from Burroughs, I recently had a letter from the principal of a New England high school putting some questions to me touching these very matters. Do children love nature? How shall we instill this love into them? How and when did I myself acquire my love for her? And so forth. In reply, I said, the child, in my opinion, does not consciously love nature. It is curious about things, about everything. Its instincts lead it forth into the fields and woods. It browses around. It gathers flowers. They are pretty. It stores up impressions. I hunted. I fished. I browsed. I wandered with a vague longing in the woods. I trapped. I went cooning at night. I made ponds in the little streams. I boiled sap in the maple woods in spring. I went to sleep under the trees in summer. I caught birds in their nests. I watched for the little frogs in the marshes. I was not conscious of any love for nature as such till my mind was brought in contact with literature. Then I discovered that I, too, loved nature and had a whole world of impressions stored up in my subconscious self upon which to draw. Can I just insert here, Pestalozzi would have called that Anschauung, or sense impressions if you've been reading A Mother's Influence. Now back to Burroughs. I found I knew about the birds, the animals, the seasons, the trees, the flowers, and that these things had become almost a grown part of me. I have been drawing upon the reservoir of youthful impressions ever since. Anything like accurate or scientific knowledge of nature, which I may possess, is of later date, but my boyhood on the farm seems to have given me the feeling and to have put in me the right relation with these things. Of course, writing about these subjects also deepens one's love for them. If nature is to be a resource in a man's life, one's relation to her must not be too exact and formal, but more that of a lover and friend. Close quote. So did you catch the key points? Let your children play in nature. They are accumulating sense impressions that will serve them later. Don't make nature an assignment or a worksheet to be completed. You must first feel the beauty yourself. You can't fake it. And then don't separate great literature and the poets from a study of nature. In the same section of the nature study book that I took that selection from, you'll read, the teacher who earnestly desires to lead children to see, to enjoy, and to love nature must dwell with the poet and the artist, as well as with the scientist. She must learn to appreciate something of the beauty they saw in forest and stream, and the joy they felt in its portrayal. When the teacher recognizes clearly the power of literature as a spiritualizing element in her own life, she will earnestly endeavor to bring the child under the influence of writers who will touch his heart, quicken his perception of beauty, and give him great and beautiful thoughts as a permanent possession. Those are the kinds of stories that you'll find in the Nature series, by the way, because they're all taken from this wonderful era of heart education. As Burroughs said, unless science is mixed with emotion and appeals to the heart and imagination, it is like dead inorganic matter, and when it is mixed and transformed, it is literature. In the Nature Study book, you'll find a book in the last half called Type Lessons for Primary Teachers in the Study of Nature, Literature, and Art. It is divided by fall, winter, and spring. I guess the teacher figured the kids were out of school for the summer, so there is no summer section. In it, you will find a lot of poetry and stories to connect to what you are seeing in nature. Feed yourself first and then share with your children. But since we're talking about stars this month, let me share a story to go along with that study. Notice how much the story has to do with being rather than just knowing. I can't help but think of the Native Americans who attached stories of being to everything their children saw in nature, so that they were constantly reminded of lessons on how to live life that their parents wanted to instill in their hearts. After you hear this story, Can you look at the Big Dipper without the impression made by the story? And by the way, if all this talk of tying literature and poetry into nature study feels so far above your head, I know it does mine. It is simply an ideal to reach towards. Small and simple steps are good enough. Like just letting your kids play in nature is a giant step upward for many of them. So go spread a blanket out under the stars this month, and if all you do is stare, you've provided a wonderful and perfect lesson on the stars. Now here's the story. A Legend of the Great Dipper. The faces of the stars shone so brightly one night that the Earth children thought the moon was telling a pretty story. And so she was, and this is the story. The Great Dipper, which you, my dear children, love to see, has a deep meaning which you are not to forget as long as the stars shine. I will tell you the story. In another world than ours, said Lady Moon, there was once great trouble and sorrow. No, it was not in the Earth world, my dear, she said to a small star who always asked questions. It was not in the heaven world either, but in another faraway world where many children lived. For some good reason, which only the Father knows, the people and children, the animals and every living thing, were suffering great thirst, and no water, nor dew, nor a drop of moisture could they find anywhere. A little child of that world went out alone in the dry, dark night, carrying a small tin dipper, and prayed very earnestly for just that little cup of water. And when she lifted the cup, it was brimming with clear, cold water, which would not spill, though she ran rapidly, her hand trembling with her faintness, for she did not taste the water, having prayed for another's need. As she ran, she stumbled and fell, for she was very weak, and when feeling about, trying to rise, she touched a little dog that seemed to be dying of thirst, and the good child poured a few drops of the precious water in the palm of her hand and let the dog lap it. He seemed so refreshed, as if he had drunk from a river. The child could not see what happened to her cup, but we saw, and sang for joy. The cup turned to silver and grew larger, the water not having become less, but more by her giving. She hurried on to give the water to one who was quite unable to come to meet her, none other than her own dear mother, who took the water eagerly, as one in a deadly fever, but without putting it to her lips, for she heard just then a weak moan which came from the faithful servant who tried to raise her mistress's head, but found she had not the strength. The mother pressed the dipper into the hands of the maid and bade her drink, feeling her own life so wasted that one little cup of water could not renew it. And neither servant nor mistress noticed that the dipper changed from silver to gold and grew larger than before. The good servant was about to give each member of the family one spoonful of the precious water when a stranger entered, dressed in a costume unknown in that country, and speaking in a strange tongue, but showing the same signs of thirst and distress as themselves. The servant said, "Sacred are the needs of the stranger in a strange land," and pressed the dipper to the parched lips of the fainting man. Then the great wonder was wrought, and the golden dipper flashed forth encrusted with the most precious diamonds, containing a fountain of gushing water, which supplied the thirsting nation as freely and surely as it had quenched the thirst of the little dog. And the stranger stood before them, a glorious, radiant being, and as he faded from their sight, a silver trumpet tone was heard to proclaim, "Blessed is he that giveth the cup of water in my name." And the possession of a dipper blazing with diamonds is in that country a sure badge of royalty, for no one can buy or receive one as a gift, nor can fathers bequeath them to their children. Each child is given the dipper at its birth, and only by purely unselfish acts can a diamond one be wrought. Some of the foolish people have not yet learned its secret, and they go about trying to exchange their tin for silver by doing kind deeds. Sometimes they accuse the father of all very bitterly because they grow old possessing only the tin dipper. For the secret of the exchange can no more be told than the beautiful, flashing, sparkling diamonds can be purchased. Sometimes there are great surprises when people give up the hope of such a possession and forget themselves, for then they often find the castaway tin bearing evidence in silver, gold, or even diamonds that they have become royal. But by that time they have no vanity because of their fortune. Only modest, thankful, brave, happy feelings possess the owners of diamond dippers. The Lady Moon now lifted a white finger toward the east, which was growing rosy, and the baby stars all knelt a moment, looking like they were at prayers. Then the morning wind swept aside the great blue silken curtain of the sky, and the moon followed her children into heaven to do whatever the Father had planned for them while they were out shining for his earth children. Bye-bye. See you next time.